honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a focus on B-17s today. One of the last ones flying, Sentimental Journey, is in the skies over Chino, California this weekend. But much more hostile skies over Europe during World War II were where a B-17 tail gunner named Vern Cole earned some significant decorations.
And on your wall are a Purple Heart medal as well as a Silver Star. And those are both the result of your 26th and final mission?
Right.
All right. Well, tell us about it. What was the mission? Where were you guys headed, and what did you think was going to happen that day in March of 1945?
We were flying to a place called Ruhlen, R-U-H-L-A-N-D, Ruhlen, Germany, which was 60 miles or so southeast of Berlin.
And you're flying all the way from your base in Italy, right?
Yes. It was a long flight, but we'd been up there the day before. I had not been on the previous mission, but our group had gone there the day before and had not got the target. And we had to go back. The Germans had moved in a bunch of extra aircraft weapons from Berlin, so the flak was extremely heavy when we went over there, over the target.
And the crew that you were flying with this day was not the same crew you had flown your previous 25 missions with, right?
Well, no, we didn't fly with the same crew every time. We flew whenever there was a chance to fly because we wanted to fill in our 35 missions and go home. So I volunteered when they needed a tail gunner for the crew across the street.
And I sense a pattern here, because all along the way, you've been given a way out or something you didn't need to do. And it sounds like you didn't need to go on this mission that day, but you said, hey, if they've got an opening, I'm taking it because it's going to get me to 35 missions sooner. Is that fair to say?
That's pretty fair to say. I wanted to get out of there.
And you had no problem volunteering, even though they say never volunteer for anything in the military.
No, that was one rule I never obeyed.
So this was a pilot named Skinner who was flying a plane called Beats Me Doc that day. Is that right?
That's right. Beats Me Doc.
And you're in the tail of that B-17.
Yes. All alone.
All by your lonesome. And so you told us what the target was, why you guys had to go back there. So what happened on that mission that changed your life forever?
Well, while we were over the target, one of the planes to my left was hit by flak and was all on fire, and the crew was bailing out, and I was paying attention to the crew bailing out. That was part of my job. I glanced to the right, and here were the damn ME-262s coming at us fast. I never saw anything so fast.
Now, and you had never seen a jet airplane before, right?
No, I had not seen ME-262s before. Or in a jet plane.
Had you heard they were out there, or was this like seeing a UFO for you?
Oh, we knew they were out there, but they rarely attacked B-17 groups because there was a lot of firepower in B-17 groups.
So you had trained as a tail gunner on shooting certain targets at certain speeds, and you'd probably seen ME-109s and some of the other German fighters before, and when you're shooting at them, they're going a certain speed and you know how to follow them. So this was like a whole new ball game for you, I'm sure.
This was entirely different because I'd never seen anything so fast.
Well, what did you do? I can't imagine being in your shoes, and you probably feel overmatched right there.
Well, if I felt overmatched, well, it didn't last long because then I was wounded on the jet's first pass. I was wounded. The top turret gunner on our plane was killed. Several of the men bailed out because a lot of the plane wasn't functioning right. No communications, for example. The top turret gunner, as I said, was killed, and one waist gunner was killed in his chute on the way down.
And for those who don't know these aircraft, I think we've kind of illuminated it, but this really is a mismatch in terms of maneuverability. If you've got this big, heavy B-17 that's designed to go in and bomb, and then you've got the fastest airplane the world has ever seen at this point, that's pretty much cherry-picking anything it wants. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. And the ME-262s didn't waste much time. They shot down four of our planes from our group that day.
And you You already mentioned some of your crew killed. Others bailed out. They ended up becoming prisoners of war, some of them. And some of this that you're telling, you've learned after the fact, because when you were wounded, you lost consciousness, right?
That's right. I learned it all after the fact, because we were bombing at 25,000 feet. I lost consciousness, and a couple of things saved my life. My flak suit saved my life when I was wounded, and the fact that the pilot immediately put the plane into a dive to get down to a lower altitude so I could breathe. My oxygen system was shot out, and I couldn't breathe otherwise, and I would have died if he hadn't brought us down to a lower altitude in a hurry.
So in terms of your flak suit saving your life, where were you hit, and how much worse would it have been without that flak suit?
I would have died without the flak suit. I was wounded in both arms and both shoulders and both hands, and my flak suit was kind of shredded. I can remember that.
And I'm sure everybody listening wants to know, when you did come to, when you regained consciousness, what did you realize? What were you thinking? And put us in your shoes. Try to help us understand what that must have been like, because I can't imagine.
Well, we had a choice every time we flew whether to wear the parachute or not. And this time I was not wearing a parachute. I was wearing the flak vest. After I was wounded, the first thing I remembered when I came to consciousness was, where's my parachute? Mm-hmm. And my hands and arms were kind of paralyzed in place, as if I were still holding the guns.
It sounds like a nightmare, to put it bluntly. And at that point, you believed you were the only person on the aircraft, right?
No, not at that point. I picked up my parachute with my teeth and carried it out into the waist. I crawled on my knees and got out into the waist, and there was nobody there, and the hatch door was open, and that's when I got really afraid. I thought I was all alone and that they had abandoned the plane. And I just sat there a moment when the bolt turret gunner came out from the pilot's area, and I could have kissed him.
You're consistent, because I read in your book about this, that the same quote, that you could have kissed him, and that sounds like the genuine emotion that you felt at the time. You could have kissed him, but you still couldn't use your hands. You'd had to carry your parachute with your teeth, and you have to figure out what you're going to do, because this plane's not going anywhere but down, right?
Well, they were still flying it. They were heading east, heading into Russian territory. They told me about the top turret gunner being killed, and how they had rolled his body out and snapped the parachute open through the bomb bay doors. And they told me that the rest of the crew had bailed out and that there were just four of us left on the plane. The pilot, the co-pilot, the bolt turret gunner. Oh, and a story, I had a waist gunner and myself. Mm-hmm. Four others on the plane beside myself. When the bolt turret gunner tried to give me first aid, and he was a big fellow, never belonged in a ball turret in the first place.
Kind of a tight squeeze in that turret?
Yes, it was. Would have been. But he helped me out in another minute or two. I don't know anything about time now. Another minute or two, it seemed that the co-pilot came out, and the co-pilot was flying his first mission. He was a major who had been training people in the States and finally decided to get some combat experience. This was his first mission. He came out, and it was just about that time that four fighter planes showed up, and the waist gunner grabbed one of the waist guns. The co-pilot was going to try the other waist gun, and he didn't know how to use it, didn't know anything about a 50 caliber machine gun. In about 45 seconds, I gave him a complete lesson on how to maintain a B-17 machine guns. And he got on the other waist gun. The planes that were out there dropped their wheels, which meant they weren't going to attack. They saw we were already shot up, mm-hmm. and we were heading down. And they dropped their wheels, and they peeled away. But I got the Silver Star for teaching the major how to use a 50 caliber machine gun under the dire circumstances.
Obviously, it made an impression on him. He was probably the one that wrote you up for the Silver Star, right?
I have no doubt about it. I met him after the war, and we had long chats. He was from California, incidentally, San Diego. Mm-hmm. We had long chats after the war.
Well, and I can see why you got the Silver Star. When I try to put myself in your shoes, it had to have taken a lot of courage and concentration and really forgetting about what you were dealing with yourself, because you can't even use your hands. You're wounded terribly, and you were unconscious just moments before, but here you are having the presence of mind to try to help somebody else shoot down some planes. Where does that come from? How do you think you pulled that off?
I've no idea. It was just there when I needed it, and I have no experience in things like that before.
And in terms of the German fighter planes, now these are propeller planes, not the ME-262s who had crippled your plane. In terms of them putting down their wheels and leaving you alone, what did that mean to you then, and what does that mean to you now when you think of what they could have done to you if they wanted to?
They could have shot us down very easily, but it would have been a waste of ammunition because we were going down anyway.
So maybe it was as much practical as it might have been noble or respectful?
Yes, I don't think it was noble or respectful. Besides, they were getting pretty well over Russian territory by then, and they probably didn't want to see any Russian planes.
That makes sense, but still, you must have been pretty thankful they did what they did for your own sake.
Yes, that was the whole story of it all. Well, they unhooked my flak vest first. That was done before the other plane showed up anyway, and put my parachute on. It was a waist ball, and hooked the parachute up, and then when they decided they were far enough into Russian territory, they were going to bail out. The pilot and co-pilot figured this out. When they decided they were going to bail out, they gave a signal to the waist gunner who was standing at the door of the cabin, and he signaled me to go on out, and I just rolled on out into the, and the strap connected my parachute to the plane, and it pulled the parachute open as I got away from the plane.
Because you still don't have the use of your arms, either one of them, right?
I had no use of my arms or hands, and it was a beautiful spring day, and I bailed out. Never forgot that.
I don't know if I would have been thinking about the beautiful spring day had I been in your shoes. And I'm sorry to be repetitive here, but you don't have the use of your arms. Normally, that's what you're going to use, your hand, to open your chute. But they basically rigged up a remote control apparatus to pull your chute for you after you were out of the plane.
That's exactly what happened.
That takes some pretty good ingenuity, doesn't it?
No, it's been done before. We were deep into the war at that time. And I'm sure that had been done on numerous planes before.
So they had heard of it or seen someone else do it or had an idea of what to do in that situation?
Yes. They found the strap, and it was easy. Up one end of the parachute and the other end of the plane.
Easy for you to say. I can't imagine it was easy floating down. You said a beautiful spring day, but then you're floating helplessly down toward the earth. You can't use either one of your arms at all. What are you thinking? And was that a short trip down to the surface, or did that seem to kind of drag on forever?
No, it was a relatively short trip. By this time, we were down less than 5,000 feet, I think. And I liked the situation. I was going to be on land again. And I'd picked out a field. Before I bailed out, I picked out a field where I thought I could land in an open field. And there was one tree in the field. And the tree caught my parachute, so the parachute didn't blow away. My feet landed on the edge of a ditch, and I slid down the ditch and hit my rump, and that saved me from breaking ankles when I landed. And I had all kinds of good things happen to me that day. I was sitting there with my feet in the ditch, wondering what I was going to do next because I couldn't use my arms and hands yet. And I saw something moving in the edge of the woods. There was forest all around us. When I finally saw a young boy, probably 12, 13 years old, at the edge of the forest, and I yelled at him, and didn't make any difference. He couldn't understand me. But he came out very cautiously and got to my parachute, pulled my parachute down from the tree, and cut the straps with a jackknife, and ran away back into the woods, stuck in my parachute behind him. And I thought, oh, hell, there goes my chance.
Well, and did you have any way of knowing who controlled the territory you were falling into? I know you were trying to get to Russian territory, but who did you expect was going to find you?
I didn't know at all. And I didn't know whether it was a German boy or Polish or Russian or whoever. I sat there a while longer, and I could hear a truck coming through the woods and hear the branches hitting the sides of the truck. And the truck came up, and here were four men on the back of the truck standing there with their rifles. They jumped down and came to me. And there was a woman riding in the passenger seat in the truck. And she came out and she spoke English. And with a British accent, of course. She referred to the truck as a lorry, for example. She spoke English, and she determined that I was an American airman. And from then on, I was taken good care of. They loaded me on the back of the truck and drove me into a town. It was kind of scary. I hear the branches slapping against the side of the truck all the time. And she drove me into a little town, and they got a doctor there. And the doctor, I'll never forget, had a beard that went down to his waist. He came out and checked me over, listened to my heart, and gave me a shot on the chest.
So the doctor is taking care of you, but you still don't know who these people are or where you're going or if they're on the right side or the wrong side, right?
I talked to the woman, and she said that they were Polish. Mm-hmm. And then they loaded me back in the truck, and they took me to a Russian field hospital, like a MASH unit. And it was on the second floor of a building, and the first floor had been shelled out, probably tank shot out. But they had to carry me up the stairs, wooden stairs on the outside, and they carried me up the stairs into this hospital, and they took care of me there. And to take care of my wounds, they brought out four water glasses on a tray, and the water glasses were filled with vodka. And they started pouring vodka down me until I passed out. After I passed out, they cleaned my wounds and bandaged them.
I guess that's when you know when you're really in a Russian hospital, huh? When they use vodka as the anesthetic.
Well, that was one way of telling. All right. But it was an experience I'll never forget. I got a lot of breaks along the way, including that very day. And after I was wounded, because when the pilot lost altitude in a hurry, that saved my life. Several times I was saved. I spent 15 months in Army hospitals. When I went home, I had casts around my chest and around both arms were cast.
Sounds like you were kind of hard to hug.
I was hard to hug.
But they found a way?
I'm sure they did.
Well, when you think back about it, and as you've stated to us, so many things that saved your life, that if they had gone a little differently, you wouldn't be here. Your kids and grandchildren would have never been born. How do you make sense of all that? Why do you think things happened the way they did?
The hand of God was on my shoulder. He took care of me. What I really want people to remember is that these were ordinary folks, ordinary citizens who became soldiers, and some of them, too many of them, died the worst way.
More than 400,000 of them, and many of them on B-17 missions like the three hair-raising missions we relive today. Thanks so much for spending another hour with us today. And if you do have a chance to experience that B-17 sentimental journey in Southern California this weekend, maybe take a look at the nose and the tail and imagine how you might have handled the situations the memories of Ralph Burbridge, Duke O'Donnell, and Vern Cole brought to life for us today. I have a feeling you might just be as dumbfounded as I am, and just as grateful for another reminder that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.